Once the queen's head is severed, he walks away. He, Thomas, Lord Cromwell. A sharp pang of appetite reminds him that it is time for a second breakfast. The morning circumstances are new, and there are no rules to guide us. The witnesses who have knelt for the passing of the soul stand up and put on their hats. Under the hats, their faces are stunned. The small body lies on the scaffold where it has fallen. Belly down, hands outstretched, it swims in a pool of crimson, the blood seeping between the planks. The Frenchman, they had sent for the Calais executioner, had picked up the head, swaddled it in linen, then handed it to one of the veiled women who had attended Anne in her last moments. As she received the bundle, the woman shuddered from the nape of her neck to her feet. Anne would have been proud of the women. They will not let any man touch her. They slide in the gore and stoop over the narrow carcass. He, Cromwell, hears their indrawn breath as they lift what is left of her, holding her by her clothes. From the corner of his eye, he sees a presence flit away, a fugitive lean man in a leather jerkin. It is Francis Bryan, a nimble courtier gone to tell Henry he is a free man. Trust Francis, he thinks. He is a cousin of the dead queen. But he has remembered he is also a cousin of the queen to come. The officers of the tower have found in lieu of a coffin an arrow chest. The narrow body fits it. The woman who holds the head genuflects with her soaking parcel and fits it by the corpse's feet. She stands up, crossing herself. The hands of the bystanders move in imitation, and his own hand moves, but then he checks himself and draws it into a loose fist. These people are incredible, he says to the Frenchman. No coffin. When they had days to prepare, they knew she was going to die. They were not in any doubt. But perhaps they were, Maître Cromwell, for I believe the lady herself thought the king would send a messenger to stop it. He was not thinking of her. His mind is entirely on his new bride. Alors, perhaps better luck this time. If I have to come back, I shall increase my fee. The man turns away and begins cleaning his sword. He does it lovingly, as if the weapon were his friend. He, Cromwell, touches a finger to the metal. You would not guess it to look at him now, but his father was a blacksmith. He has affinity with iron, steel, with everything that is mined from the earth or forged. The executioner's blade is incised with Christ's crown of thorns and with the words of a prayer. Now the spectators are moving away. Courtiers and aldermen and city officials, knots of men in silk and gold chains, in the livery of the Tudors and in the insignia of the London guilds. Scores of witnesses, none of them sure of what they have seen.
She didn't suffer, Cromwell,
Charles Brandon says. My Lord Suffolk, you may be satisfied she did. Brandon disgusts him. When the other witnesses knelt, the Duke stayed rigid on his feet. He so hated the Queen that he would not do her that much courtesy. He remembers her faltering progress to the scaffold. Even when she said her last words, asking the people to pray for the king, she was looking over the head of the crowd. Still, she did not let hope weaken her. Few women are so resolute at the last, and not many men. There was no block. The man from Calais did not use one. One of her women bound a cloth across her eyes. She did not see the sword, not even its shadow, and the blade went through her neck with a sigh easier than scissors through silk. Now the elm chest is carried towards the chapel, where the flags have been lifted so she can go in by the corpse of her brother, George Boleyn.
They shared a bed when they were alive, Brandon says, so it's fitting they share a tomb. Let's see how they like each other now. "Come, Master Cromwell," says the constable of the tower. "I have arranged a collation, if you will do me the honour." Young Gregory Cromwell asks the constable, "Sir William, has a Queen of England ever been executed before?"
"Not to my knowledge, or at least not on my watch. I'd have put her on a dunghill," Brandon says, "and the brother underneath her, and I'd have made their father witness it. Why did you leave him alive to work mischief, Cromwell?"
He turns on Brandon, angry. Often anger is what he fakes.
"My Lord Suffolk,
you have often offended the king yourself and begged his pardon on your knees. Do you want a king to whom the notion of mercy is foreign?" The courtiers tramping across the green eye them. Suffolk with his big beard, his flashing eye, his big chest, and Master Secretary Cromwell, sub-fusc, low-slung, square.
"By God," Brandon says, "you read me a lesson, I, a peer of the realm, and you, from the place where you come from?"
"I stand just where the king has put me. I will read you any lesson you should learn." He thinks, "Cromwell, what are you doing? Usually he is the soul of courtesy. But if you cannot speak truth at a beheading, when can you speak it?" They step aside to bow to the Duke of Richmond, Henry Fitzroy, the king's bastard son. He is a handsome boy, with his father's fine flushed skin and red blonde hair, a tender plant, willowy, a boy who has not yet grown into his great height. Richmond greets him.
"Master Secretary, England is a better place this morning,"
Gregory says. "My lord, you also did not kneel. How is that?" Richmond blushes. He knows he is in the wrong. But, like his father, he will defend himself with a stout self-righteousness.
"My lord father has declared to me how Boleyn would have poisoned me. Well, now her monstrous adulteries are all found out and she is properly punished. You are not ill, my lord."
Richmond turns away.
"I am only tired."
Gregory's eyes follow Richmond.
"Do you think he can ever be king?"
"If he is, he'll remember you."
"You told me, the moment you see the blade in the air, then she is dying, bow your head and close your eyes, but I saw you. You were looking."
"Of course I was."
He takes his son's arm.
"It would be like the late Queen to pin her head back on, pick up the sword and chase me to Whitehall."
"She may be dead," he thinks, "but she can still ruin me."
Breakfast. Fine white loaves, wine of head-spinning strength. The Duke of Norfolk, the dead woman's uncle, gives Master Secretary a nod.
"Most corpses wouldn't fit in a narrow chest, eh? You'd have to hack the arms off. Do you think the constable's getting past it?"
By now the witnesses have seen the late Queen nailed down and are packing in at the open doors. The city officers jostle, keen for a word with him. One question in their mouths. "Master Secretary Cromwell, when shall we see the new Queen? Will Jane ride through the streets or sail in the royal barge? What arms and emblems will she take as Queen, and what motto?"
He says, "Gentlemen, I can tell you what the new Queen will take as her motto. It is bound to obey and serve."
There is a murmur of approbation that runs right around the room. Brandon's big laugh booms out.
"Better safe than sorry, eh?" "So say we all."
Norfolk tips back his canary wine.
"Whoever crosses the king in the years ahead, gentlemen, it will not be Thomas Howard here."
He stabs a finger into his own breastbone. Then he slaps Master Secretary on the shoulder with every appearance of comradeship.
"So what now, Cromwell?"
Don't be deceived. Uncle Norfolk is not our comrade or our ally or our friend. He is slapping us to appraise how solid we are. He is eyeing the Cromwell bull neck. He is wondering what sort of blade you'd need to slice through that.
It is 10 when they break away from the company. Outside he walks into shadow, his nephew Richard Cromwell by his side. Better see Wyatt. It was Richard who had walked Thomas Wyatt to the tower, without display of force, without armed men. How is this prisoner? Richard asks the jailer, as if this prisoner were just anyone, instead of what Wyatt is, as dear to the Cromwells as any person now living. The room is full of dancing light, and the young man sits at a table in full sun. Still alive, when 5 other men are dead, still alive and astonished to be so. He looks up. So it's done, I suppose? She made a brave end, Richard says, asking forgiveness, praising the king's mercy, and offering no extenuation. She accused no one. I know she was a creature of supreme malice, Master Secretary says. But surely she would not have wished to add to the number of men she has ruined. She might have thought it was justice, Wyatt says. Tom Wyatt, do not for God's sake confess to me. You spoke when you should speak. Now speak no more. You must not indulge yourself, Wyatt, Richard says. It would be at our expense. My uncle has walked a knife edge for you. He thinks Wyatt doesn't trust me. Still, even now. God knows I have not played him false. He says to him, I told your father I'd look after you, and I have. Indebted, Wyatt says. Outside, the red kites are skimming over the tower walls. The king did not choose to display the heads of Anne's lovers on London Bridge, in case he decides to ride through with his new wife. The kites, therefore, are cheated of their prey. Are the arrests finished? Richard asks him. Was Wyatt the last? Yes, I think so. Is it over, then? Over? Oh, no. Thomas Cromwell is now 50 years old. The same small, quick eyes, the same thick-set, imperturbable body, the same schedules. He is at home wherever he wakes, the Rolls House on Chancery Lane, or his city house at Austin Friars, or at Whitehall with the King, or in some other place where Henry happens to be. Though he is a commoner still, most would agree that he is the second man in England. He is famous for his memory. He sometimes carries a sprig of dried rosemary or rue and crumbles it in his palm as if inhaling the scent would help him. But everyone knows it is only a performance. The only things he cannot remember are the things he never knew. His chief duty, it seems, just now, is to get the king new wives and dispose of the old. Master Secretary Cromwell demands, "Where's my orange coat?" Richard Cromwell, his nephew, says, "You put that coat away when the Cardinal came down." "Yes, but now I am cheerful. I'm not going to appear before the bridegroom as a mourner." The King's wedding was yesterday, a small and private ceremony. Today they are a loyal deputation, ready to congratulate the new Queen. For this is England, a land of miracles. The Boleyn's white falcon hangs like a sorry sparrow on a fence, while the Seymour phoenix is rising. The king wears green velvet. He has a verdant lawn starred with diamonds. He takes Master Secretary's arm, draws him into a window embrasure. So, the wedding night, how does one ask? The new bride is of such virginal aspect that it would surprise no one if she had slipped beneath the bed and spent the night rigid on her back praying. And Henry, as several women have mentioned, needs a lot of encouragement. The king whispers, "Such freshness, such delicacy, such maidenly pudeur. I am happy for your majesty." He thinks, "Yes, yes, but did you manage it? I have come out of hell into heaven, and all in one night." That is the answer he needed. The king says, "Thomas, you know I have hesitated to promote you only because your grip is wanted in the House of Commons, but," he smiles, "the House of Lords is equally unruly and wants a master, so to the Lords you shall go." He bows. "Lord Cromwell." Small rainbows flit and dance across the stonework. "The Queen is with her women," Henry adds. "I have asked her to show herself to the court." The women around Jane are in their finery, and in the heat of mid-morning the scent of lavender ripples into air like bubbles of laughter. Jane, regrettably pale and, as usual, silent, is a little doe figure in their midst. Her family sweep in. Her mother, Lady Marjorie, two brothers. Lady Marjorie's glance stabs at the old dames. None of their girls have become queens. Then Jane turns her head and lets her pale glance wash over him. "Master Secretary," she says, "would you like to kiss my hand?" He, Cromwell, finds himself on one knee, lips touching an emerald he had kissed on the narrow hand of the late Anne. "So, sister?" Tom Seymour says. Jane considers. "I can only say I find myself wholly unprepared for what the king asks of me." "You are 27 years old, Jane. I mean, your grace," Lady Marjorie says. "I am sure the king was not unkind." "No, not unkind. But my difficulty is, he wants me to do some very strange things. Things I never imagined a wife had to do." "Unpleasant things, Jane?" "I think so." "The point is," Edward says, "this, whatever his desire, his command, does it conduce to getting a child?" "I wouldn't have thought so," Jane says. "Cromwell," Edward says, "you'll have to recall to him how a Christian man behaves." He, Master Secretary, takes Jane's hands between his. "Your Grace, put aside modesty and tell me what it is the king requires of you." Jane slides her hands away and falters in the direction of her king, her court, her future. She whispers as she goes, "He wants me to ride down to Dover with him and see the fortifications." Unsmiling, Jane walks the length of the chamber. Henry stretches out his arms as one does for a child learning to walk, and when he has her, he kisses her full on the mouth. At the door of the Privy Chamber, Master Secretary Cromwell is ushered through. The king is seated, slumped, elbows on knees. His verdant sheen has greyed. He makes his reverence. "Majesty." On the table before the king, his walnut writing box lies open. Henry says, "My daughter Mary has sent a letter. She seems to entertain expectations about her future as my heir, as if she believes Jane will fail in giving me a son." "She won't fail, sir." "That is easy to say, Cromwell. But last night, in a dream..." "Ah," he thinks, "you see her too, Anna Bolena with her collar of blood." Henry says, "Did I do right?" "Right?" The magnitude of the question checks him. "Was I just? No. Was I prudent? No. Did I do the best thing for my country? Yes." "It's done," he says.
Go forward, sir. The Queen will give you a son. All Europe sees and admires the stand you have taken against the pretended authority of Rome.
They see it, Henry says. They don't admire it.
He, Master Secretary Cromwell, stands over his prince. Time to remind him what the bloodletting has been for.
I am talking to the Emperor's envoy every day. You know his master is ready to make an alliance.
The king is restless.
Crum, what if some accident befalls? I could die tomorrow. I cannot leave my kingdom to my daughters, the one truculent and half Spanish, the other an infant, and neither of them born in wedlock. My next heir would be the Queen of Scotland's daughter, but my sister being what she is, we cannot be wholly sure Meg Douglas was born in wedlock either. And I ask you, a woman, weak in body, weak in will, can she rule with all the frailty of her sex? A woman ruler is only storing up trouble. There is only one way. We will have to bring young Richmond forward as my heir. So, how will Parliament take it?
Very ill, he thinks.
I believe they will urge your majesty to trust in God and use your best endeavours to get a son of your marriage. In the interim, we can make an instrument that allows your majesty to name a successor at your pleasure. A small hiccuping laugh.
Do you sleep at night, Crum?
The question is not barbed. Only, Henry adds, if I promote you to Lord Privy Seal, you will hold a great office of state. And if you remain Master Secretary, it is a burden of work no man has carried before. But then, you are like the Cardinal. You can do the work of 10. I often wonder where you come from.
Putney, Majesty. At Austin Friars there are always crowds about the Cromwell Gate, shouting his name and thrusting papers at him. Half of London wants to get inside and get a position with him. He passes into the courtyard, then to the kitchens. He tells his cook, Thurston, Ambassador Chapuis, to supper. It will be just the two of us.
Of course it will, Thurston says.
He sieves his flour, allowing little puffs and billows to rise between them.
Somebody said to me that Chapuis fellow, the Emperor's man, he and your master plotted it all between them to kill the Queen. I told him the Emperor is King of Spain and Lord of half the world. No wonder my master wants to be in bed with him.
I clasp him to my bosom, he says. At his feet, eels are swimming in a pail, twisting and gliding.
Are you just going to stand talking? Thurston asks. Or are you killing those eels for me?
He looks down into the pail and turns back his sleeves. At dinner, the eels come in, presented in two fashions, salted in an almond sauce and baked with the juice of an orange.
Bon appetit, the host says. I've had a letter, Ambassador.
Yes, Chapuis says.
From the Princess Mary?
His host hunches forward. The Princess, as you call her, the Lady Mary, believes her father will welcome her back to court. She thinks that with the change of wife her troubles are over. You must disillusion her. She must take the oath.
Chapuis takes a portion of eel between finger and thumb.
Let me be exact, Cromwell, about what you ask of Mary. She must recognize that her mother's marriage was of no effect, and that she, though the king's eldest child, is not his heir. She must swear to uphold as the king's successor the little daughter of Boleyn, whom he has just killed.
The oath will be revised. Eliza will be excluded.
Good, and this is excellent, the ambassador says, addressing the eel. So, what does Henry intend now? My master will not accept young Richmond in Mary's place.
Parliament will settle up the succession.
Not Henry's whim,
then?
Mary claims she has no desire to be queen, but she cannot accept her father as head of the church.
That is also a difficulty.
Tell me, Chapuis, does Mary think we are headed back to Rome because Anne Boleyn is dead?
The emperor hopes, of course, for the success of the new marriage. So we must wish Henry, how does Boccaccio put it, a resurrection of the flesh. A boy brings in the veal. He, Cromwell, takes up the carving knife. I dare say Henry was appalled at what emerged once the investigation began. I understand how it was. Henry says, Cromwell, find me a reason to be rid of Anne. But he cannot have been prepared for what you would uncover. Perhaps he will not forgive you, mon cher, for exposing him to ridicule.
On the contrary, he is promoting me.
Yet the business must rankle.
I warn you, Ambassador, if Mary enrages her father, it will come home to your door. Chapuis takes a sliver of veal.
Henry will not kill his daughter.
Who knows what Henry will do? Not I.
Well, Europe knows how frail is his grip on the future. Only last January,
the memory is sharp, the king's horse had come down and Henry took a blow to the head. The ambassador picks at his salad.
Cromwell, you are playing with the greatest men in the land. You cannot stand alone, because if the new marriage does not last, what have you? You have Henry's favour, but if he withdraws it, you know Cardinal Wolsey's fate. For when all is said, you are a blacksmith's son. Your whole life depends on the next beat of Henry's art, and your future on his smile or frown.
Behind the presence chamber, in a small panelled cabinet, the Duke of Richmond receives him, Thomas Cromwell, and his colleague, Richard Rich. The young Duke is wearing a long gown and a nightcap. A few spots of rain spatter the window.
It's not the sweating sickness, Rich says reassuringly.
No, the boy says, or I would not have summoned you here, masters, lest you be infected. They bow, thankful that their lives are considered, common men such as they be. Fitzroy says, Rich, I thank you for your gentle attendance, but now I wish to confer with Master Secretary. Rich falters, lingers, bows himself out. Fitzroy says, Cromwell, are there such things as slow poisons? He is startled.
You suspect the late Queen has poisoned you?
My father said she would have done it if she could.
But your Lord Father was in a state of...
A what?
He was shocked by the discovery of the late Queen's crimes.
She was a witch. Richmond's fingers restless tug at the string of his cap. Do you think Jane the Queen will bear a son?
All England knows, my lord, she comes from fertile stock.
Yes, but if it is true, what was claimed in court, that the king cannot please a woman or serve her as he ought.
I earnestly recommend, sir, drop this matter.
But Richmond is a king's son, and he sails on. My brother-in-law Surrey tells me the Parliament has done ill in framing the new bill of succession. They have left the king to choose his own heir when they should have named me foremost.
Thank God the boy had the sense to send Rich out of the room.
I want to be king, Richmond says. I am fitted for it. Surrey says my father should recognise that. If he should die now, I am not afraid of the whelp Eliza, for she is only the concubine's child. There is not a man in the nation who will lift a finger for her claim.
This much is true.
As for the Lady Mary, if I am a bastard, so is she. And I am true English, and she is half Spanish. And I am a man. Besides, they say she will not swear to my father's titles as head of the church. And if she will not, she is a plain traitor.
Mary will swear, he says.
She may sign a paper. If you force her, but my lord father will see through her. Did my lord Surrey suggest you raise this? I am my own man.
He inclines his head. My lord, I cannot remake the succession. The new arrangement reflects the king's will.
You will find a way, Cromwell. Every man says you are master of the parliament. When I am king, I shall reward you.
I shall hardly live so long.
I think you will. My father's leg is sore since he took his fall in January. I am advised an old wound has reopened, and there is a channel in his flesh that lies open to the bone.
If that is true, then he bears the pain with great fortitude.
If that is true, it will putrefy and he will die.
With every breath he commits treason and does not hear it.
You should rest, my lord, and let your indisposition pass.
The boy calls after him. Do it, Cromwell!
God help me, what are princes? They think on murder all day long. A patricide now, as if the season does not hold enough surprises.
June 1536. The Duke of Richmond walks in procession with the House of Lords. His handsome face is flushed with portent, as if he feels his future in a warm breeze. There are men who believe that with the change of queen, the tide will turn and England go back to Rome. As sufficient answer, Lord Cromwell brings into Parliament an act extinguishing the authority of the Bishop of Rome. The title is a guide to its content. As Parliament meets, so too the bishops meet in convocation. He, Lord Cromwell, is enthroned among them as Henry's deputy, vicegerent of the church under God and the king.
To think, his son Gregory says, that my father is over all the bishops.
I am not over them. I'm only... He stops.
True, I am over them.
He smiles. A courtier approaches.
Master Secretary Cromwell, the king has received a letter from a cousin of his. He is screaming as if it came hot from the pit and signed by the devil.
He, Cromwell, enters the royal presence. Henry says to the buzzing swarm, "Will you allow me to have conference now with my Lord Privy Seal?" There is a stir. Henry is for the first time speaking his new title aloud. After the stir, a shuffle, then a scuttle backwards, bowing. Henry has a thick folio in front of him.
"Pole," he says. "His book has come out of Italy. My subject, my liegeman, Reginald Pole. My cousin, my trusted kin. The one thing I cannot endure," Henry says, "is ingratitude, disloyalty."
He, Cromwell, moves to pick up the manuscript, but the king drops his hand on it.
"First, there is a note to me. Cold and insolent in tone. I am a greater danger to Christians than the infidel Turk. He calls me a Nero and a wild beast. He advises the Emperor Charles to invade. He claims that for the whole of my reign I have plundered my subjects and dishonoured the nobility. They are now ready to revolt, he claims, lords and commons both, and he exhorts them to rise up and murder me."
"It must strike your majesty that a rising such as he advocates cannot only be against somebody. It must also be for somebody."
"Of course. Pole exhorts Europe to take arms against me, and at the very same hour my own daughter defies me. His family schemes to marry him to my daughter."
Neat, if they could do it. Mary Tudor carries the best blood of Spain, united with Plantagenet blood. That's the thinking. The Pole family and their allies dream of a new England, which is to say, an old one, where they rule again.
"I believe," he says, "that the Lady Mary regards your Majesty's favour more than that of any bridegroom. These people who call themselves her supporters, they take advantage of her youth and frailty.
Henry walks to the window.
Promise what you like. Get Reginald back here. I want to look him in the eye.
At the meeting of his councillors, Henry falls into his seat with a little grunt.
A cushion, Majesty?
Lord Audley suggests. Henry closes his eyes. Thank you, no. Today there is only one matter to discuss. All the councillors know it. That dangerous twitch of the king's mouth. To be defied by my daughter. To know that my own kin and cousins urge her on. To be reviled in my own house by that monster of ingratitude, Pole. I warn you, if I hear one voice raised in support of that errant creature, my daughter, I shall know I am hearing treason. I have called in the judges to consider what is the best way to bring her to trial.
Master Treasurer Fitzwilliam slaps his palm on the table.
Trial? Jesus, save us! Your flesh and blood! I implore you, think before you do this. You will make yourself a monster in the sight of all.
He, Lord Cromwell, cuts in. Majesty, Mary is ill. Henry turns to him. Tell me, Crom, when is she not ill? I wonder if so weakly a creature can be mine. I wonder what God meant by it. Fitzwilliam says, well, if you don't know Harry, who does? You are his deputy, are you not? You know all our fates.
I know yours, Henry says.
The king glances up to the doors. A nod, and the guards would march in.
Go on, Fitzwilliam. Take yourself out of the council chamber before I have you taken. My patience is not infinite, neither with you nor my daughter.
Again that tight smile. Henry is in pain.
Master Secretary promised me he could get her compliance, that he would make her swear the oath without stirring himself from Whitehall, but he, too, has failed me.
Fitzwilliam is almost out of the room, but he turns to face the councillors.
Some of us are trying to save you from yourself, Majesty. You are flailing and injuring all about because Pole has insulted you. As for Mary, she will say she is not a bastard but a princess of England, and that you are no more head of the church than I am. Then what will you do? Cut off her head?
Lord Audley turns down his mouth.
Brave man?
Dead man, Edward Seymour murmurs. He, Lord Cromwell, rises from his place. He strides across the room, grasps Fitzwilliam by his coat, and bundles him towards the doors. He seizes the treasurer's chain of office, trying to loop it over his head. The councillor bellows. They tussle.
Hands off me, Cromwell,
he bawls, and swipes at him with his other fist. But with a grip on the chain, he hauls Fitz nose to nose, spitting into his face.
Give it over, you dolt.
Fitz comprehends. He yelps as the chain flies free, staggers backward. He, Lord Cromwell, crosses the room and drops the chain on the table before the king. Clank.
That won't do, Cromwell, Henry says. Getting up a fight for my benefit when I know you agree with him.
He won't look at his councillors.
I do know what you all say and how you scheme to govern me. If Mary has entertained some notion that I will creep back to Rome, she is a greater fool than I thought her. But what none of you seems to understand is that I love my daughter. If I lose her, what have I? And so, Lord Cromwell, you will bring this matter to a conclusion. We shall not come here to debate again.
Even when the doors are closed after him, they do not speak. Till Audley says,
conclusion? What conclusion, my Lord Cromwell?
God knows, he says. In the parlour with the lapis tiles, the flame of a single wax candle shimmering in the blue, he, Lord Cromwell, drafts a letter. It is hard for him to become the king's daughter. He begins,
most humbly prostrate before your majesty, I write to... Why do I write?
to open my heart to your grace. I do repute and acknowledge the King's Highness to be supreme head under Christ of the Church of England. He dries the ink. I have written letters for Mary before, he thinks. More pitiful than this, they met with small success. I want Rafe to take this to Mary's house at Hunsdon, he says. Get it signed tonight. She must not read it, so that if times change, she can repudiate it. But if she will not sign, I cannot save her life. And even if God preserves her, I will not see her or speak to her again. In the first week of July 1536, the king indicates that he is ready to meet his daughter Mary, not yet to bring her to court. But the queen is urging me, he says, and I thought you, Cromwell, might manage it so as just to allow me to see her, allow me to judge her feelings towards me. And, Crum, I don't want to ride too far. The physicians are in daily consultation. Young Richmond was right. Decay runs deep into the bone. Next year, the king might be dead. When the great day comes to meet his contrite and obedient daughter, the king wears white and gold, the queen white and silver. Henry beams around the room. This day has been long in coming. You may bring Mary to us, Cromwell. He turns to Ralph Sadler. Lord Cromwell has behaved to my lady daughter with such tenderness and care that he could not have done more if he were my kinsman. Which, of course, the king seems surprised at his own words. He could not be. But I mean to reward him and all his house. Lady Shelton, will you go with him? Lady Shelton has ridden from Hertfordshire in Mary's train, along with her chest of new clothes. As they walk upstairs together, she says, The king looks lighter in himself. You would almost think Jane has given him good news, though I suppose it is too soon for that. Some women seem to know at the very moment they conceive. When there is a king in the case, you would not risk mistake. At the head of the stair he stops. How shall I find Mary? Silent. But well-dressed, I trust. Every day since Mary was persuaded to conform to her father's wishes, Bounty by the cartload has been bumping over the roads out of Bishopsgate to her house at Hunsdon. He, Cromwell, has spoken to Hans Holbein about a design for a fine emerald to be set as a pendant with pearls. And, if the king sees fit, her dead mother's furs will be given to Mary to keep her warm this winter ahead. Mary looks up at his arrival. Cromwell, she says. A lady is kneeling, making some adjustment to Mary's hem. It is Margaret Douglas, the king's red-headed niece. Lady Meg is here, Mary says, as if he might not notice her. The king thought she should be, as it was a family occasion. He offers a hand. Meg ignores it. My lady, he says, are you ready? Meg is train-bearer. Mary is stiff and precarious in her new gown of crimson and black. You have to hold your breath as she negotiates every tread on the stair. The King of England's daughter on one hand, the Queen of Scotland's child on the other. To a boy from Putney, such moments seem like the work of some artificer who designs to weave them in wool or flowers. Mary glances around as if to check he is following. Meg gives her train a shake. She seems to steer the king's daughter from behind with clucks and murmurs, like a woman driving a cart. We have done our best with her, Lady Shelton sighs. In my opinion, a gentler hue would have flattered her complexion, but she wished to be as regal as possible. What's the matter with the Scots girl, Cromwell? Doesn't she like you? It happens, he says. At the foot of the stairs, Mary stops abruptly. My Lord Cromwell?
Meg releases one long, outraged breath. Madam, the king is waiting. I forgot to thank you for the dapple grey you sent me. My lady does look better for the exercise, Lady Shelton says. A little colour in her cheeks. Her name was Douceur, Mary says. It is a good name, but I have renamed her. I have called her Pomegranate. It was my mother Catherine's emblem. May God rest and keep her. I hope my father sees his errors now. I hope we can kneel and pray for her together. Lady Shelton closes her eyes as if in pain. Mary gains the threshold. The doors are flung open. The king and queen are still against the light. Golden sun and silver moon. Mary takes in a deep, ragged breath. And he stands behind her, because what else can he do? That evening, the king releases him so he can be alone with his family. They will retire early, and there will be no policy discussed or papers signed. When the Chronicles of the Reign are composed, they will reimagine the meeting between the king and his daughter, the orations they made each other, the promises, the blessings. They will not have witnessed, they could not record, the Lady Mary's wobbling curtsy, or how the king's face flushes as he crosses the room and sweeps her up, her sniffling and whimpering as she grips the white gold tissue of his jacket, his gasp, his sob, his broken endearments, and the hot tears that spring from his eyes. Jane, the queen, stands dry-eyed, shy, until a thought strikes her and she removes a jewel from her finger. Here, wear this. Mary's mewling cuts off. Oh, Mary juggles with the ring, almost drops it. It is a vast diamond, and it holds the light of the afternoon in an ice-white grasp. Meg Douglas grips Mary's wrist and hoops the jewel on a finger. Oh, too big! Mary is desolate.
It can be reset. The king holds out his flat palm. The gem vanishes into some pocket. You are generous, sweetheart, he says to Jane.
No one can mistake the flicker in the king's eye as he calculates the worth of the stone.
You are gracious, madam, Mary tells the queen. I hope you will have a child soon. I shall pray for it daily. I take you now as my own lady mother, as if God had ordained the same. But, the queen says, perturbed, she motions her husband to bend his head, whispers to him. He says, smiling,
the queen says it would be hard even for God to ordain, as she is but 7 years your senior. Mary stares at the queen.
Tell her it is an expression of my regard. It is an established form of well-wishing.
She understands, don't you, sweetheart? Henry smiles down at Jane. Shall we go in? The servants wait, kneeling, for the royal party to pass. The king checks his stride. His wife and daughter face each other in the doorway. I will not go in before you, Jane says.
Madam, you are the queen. You must.
Jane holds out her hand, naked without its diamond. That star, pocketed, beams its rays at the king's belly. Let us go in like sisters, Jane says. Neither one before the other. Henry glows with pleasure. Is she not a jewel in herself? Is she not, Cromwell? On the way to his summer house,
Pomegranate, Ralph says.
He groans. I should have known he was going too well. Thomas Risley, call me Risley, as the household knows him, arrives arm in arm with Richard Rich. They take their seats in the arbour. Pitchers of white wine rest in a bowl of cold water on the ground.
To your success, sir, Rich drinks.
Though you ran it to the danger point.
You should have heard the king, Ralph says.
When he spoke of what he owes our master, he said Lord Cromwell could not be more to me if he were my own kin.
Then he remembered I was of mean parentage, he says, smiling. If it were not for that, he would very much like to be related to me.
He looks around at them.
I had to let Mary fetch herself to where we needed her to be.
You were there, Rich, the day the king threw Fitzwilliam out of the council chamber.
It was you who threw him out, my Lord Cromwell.
Master Risley touches his arm. Sir, your friends wish me to say that they hope you do not lose by the amity you have shown the king's daughter.
I promised Catherine I would look after her.
What?
Rafe is shocked.
When?
When I went up to Kimbolton in winter, when Catherine was ill.
I remember, he thinks, how painfully clasping her hands on the arms of her chair, Catherine got to her feet, and her furs slid to the floor in a soft, feral heap.
I am dying, as you see, Cromwell,
she said.
When the time comes that I can no longer protect her, do not let them harm the Princess Mary. I commend her to your care.
Gregory says,
you made such a vow, Father. Why did you do it?
I pitied her, he says. A dying woman in a strange country.
You know what I am, he thinks. In the Cardinal's day, they used to call me the butcher's dog. A butcher's dog is strong and fills its skin. I am that, and I am a good dog, too. Set me to guard something, I will do it.
Richard Cromwell says, you could not know, sir, what Catherine was asking. That's the point of a promise, he says. It wouldn't have any value if you could see what it would cost you when you made it.
Richard Rich says, tell me, sir, I am curious, how far does it extend, your care of the Lady Mary? Were she openly to rebel against the king, what would you do then? He is silent. He thinks,
I bound myself. Why did I?
Rich says, does Mary know of this? This, what shall we term it, this undertaking?
No one knows except myself and the Dowager Catherine.
And you know now. Rich says, best if it goes no further. Richard Cromwell looks up. Don't try and make it a dirty little secret, Rich. It was an act of kindness. No more. The light falters. Nesting birds rustle under the eaves. The Lady Mary is not to stay at court. Tomorrow she is to go back to Hertfordshire. The King and Queen are planning their first summer together. When Parliament rises, they will go hunting. The ring, so impulsively offered by the Queen, will be reduced to fit the King's daughter. In recompense, the emerald pendant of Holbein's design will be worn not by Mary, the branch and flower of Aragon and Castile, but by Jane, the daughter of John Seymour of Wolf Hall. At midsummer, the walls of the tower are splashed with banners and streamers in the colours of the sun and the sea. Queen Jane is shown to the Londoners. She rides with Henry to Mercer's Hall for the ceremony of setting the city watch. A parade of 2,000 men, escorted by torchbearers, walks from Paul's down Westcheap and Aldgate and by Fenchurch Street back to Cornhill. And there are dancers and Morris men and giants, wine and cakes and ale and bonfires glowing as the light fades. London, thou art the flower of cities all. Early July 1536. The grandee hold a triple wedding, combining their fortunes and ancient names. Margaret Neville weds Henry Manners. Anne Manners weds Henry Neville. Dorothy Neville weds John de Vere. The king himself goes to Shoreditch for the marriage celebrations. He and his suite are dressed as Turks in velvet turbans, breeches of striped silk,
and scarlet boots with tassels. At the end of the evening, the king unmasks to general astonishment and applause. Henry's son, the young Duke of Richmond, leaves early, heated and flushed from dancing and wine. So does Mr. Risley, though his exit is more sudden. William Fitzwilliam, who has regained his chain of office as Master Treasurer, looks after him.
"Tell me, Cromwell, do you trust young Risley?"
He rubs his chin. "You don't trust anybody, do you?"
"We all need second chances, Fitz."
He, Cromwell, flips the Treasurer's chain of office. This last week or so, whenever Cromwell comes near, Lord Chancellor Audley clutches his own chain in mock panic. Just Audley's little joke. He knows well enough by now that Lord Cromwell has no ambition to be Chancellor. Master Secretary's post gives him warrant for anything he needs to do and keeps him close to Henry, day by day, privy to his every sign. By mid-July, arrangements are underway to set up the Lady Mary in a household of her own. At their last meeting, she had said in a low voice meant only for him, "Lord Cromwell, I am bound to you. I am bound to pray for you during my life." But it may be that fortune turns and he needs more than prayers. So he has called in Hans to design a present for Mary. He wants to give her something to remind her of these last perilous weeks, the brink and who pulled her back from it. He is thinking of a ring engraved with proverbs in praise of obedience. The engravers are cunning. They can write a prayer or verse very small. "Oh, why should you not," Hans says, "have it made into a pendant? You could get more good advice on it that way."
But a ring is more
of a promise," Hans says. "Thomas, I wonder that you can be so." But then a message comes in. The Duke of Richmond, Henry's son, must see him at once. He never manages to finish a conversation these days.
"Yes, I'm on my way," he says.
And to Hans, "Give it some thought." At St. James's, Richmond's people usher him to the sick room, shuttered against the midsummer heat. "Dr. Butts," he says, nodding. He makes his bow to a miserable heap under the bedclothes. At the sound of his voice, the young Duke stirs.
"Cromwell, you did not do what I said. I told you Parliament must name me heir."
He punches the pillow away, as if it were interfering with his rights.
"Why is my name not in the bill?"
"Your Lord Father is still advising on the matter," he says easily. "The bill permits him liberty to decide who follows him, and you know you stand high in his favour." A great bowl of water stands atop a brazier, bubbling away to moisten the air. Richmond leans forward, coughing. His face is burning, his nightshirt patched with sweat. When he masters the fit, he subsides, white as the linen. The boy begins to talk, but there is little sense in what he says. When his eyelids flutter and close, Butts makes a gesture, "Creep over here, my Lord Cromwell." "Richmond was fretting about poison," the doctor says. "When the fever was high, he said, 'My father-in-law has done this. He does not need me now. When I married his daughter, he thought I was his path to the throne, but now he has found another way.'" He is alarmed. "Dr. Butts, were there any witnesses to my lord's words?"
"Dr. Cromer was standing by, but with God's help and with our science, we have suppressed the fever, and with it all talk of poison."
"Will he mend?"
"We must hope so, my Lord Cromwell. I have seen off worse cases."
Over the heads of Richmond's retainers, Mr. Risley calls,
"My Lord Cromwell."
Shouldering through, the young man swats the air with his feathered cap, his face glowing, his shirt neck unlaced. Dr. Butts touches his cap in farewell as Risley talks at him. They walk into a blaze of sunshine.
"Sir, I have made pressing inquiries among the Scottish princesses' folk."
"To what end?"
I have been sure this long while that something is amiss with Meg Douglas. I have seen her furtive manner whenever you are by. So, what have you found?
Not a lover.
It came to me at the wedding, but I could not speak till I had proof.
So who is he? And who knew?
Some of the women knew, Mr. Risley says. But I leave the women to you.
So much is explained, then. The scuffling and haste, the shushing, the whisk of skirts and the slammed doors, the indrawn breath, the glance, the sigh, the sideways look, a swift progress up staircases and through candle-lit rooms to what? To kisses and illicit embraces, to promises and sighs, and so to feather bed where Meg Douglas, the king's niece, disposes herself against the pillows and waits for her pleasure.
Call me, says, it is Thomas Howard, the younger, I mean, Norfolk's half-brother, wooed her with his verses, sir, undressed her with his wit.
Wreckage, he thinks. He, Cromwell.
Winter and spring we watched Anne Boleyn, and we should have watched another lady. We'll talk to Meg first, he says. First comes her shock, indignation, denial. How dare he inquire into her life? I am informed, he says, and she says, how, Cromwell, how are you informed? By your own people, he says. He sees how hard she takes that, bursting into hot, angry tears the size of apple pips. Thomas Howard and I are married. Cromwell, you have no right to cast doubt on my word. Take me to see my uncle the king.
Better off with me, my lady, in the first instance. Certainly, I can broach it with the king, but first we must think how to present your case.
Deny it, he tells Meg, under his breath. Deny the whole and deny every part, then persist in denial. No words, no witnesses. No marriage.
I have given Lord Thomas my portrait, set with a diamond, and he has given me a ring.
A ring is not a pledge. For example, I am having a ring made for the Lady Mary. Pleasant token that indicates friendship, nothing more. If you were really married, you would have to live with the king's extreme displeasure. And I cannot say what form that would take.
My uncle will not punish me. He loves me as he loves his own daughter.
She falters there. From her own mouth she hears it, and now she understands. How does the king love his daughter? 2 weeks past, Mary stood on thin ice. It was cracking under her feet. Only Thomas Cromwell would walk on it to retrieve her.
Call me Risley rises, as if Meg might faint. Meg says,
I see, I have wronged the king, I see that now. But my marriage is not a crime, is it?
Not yet, he says, but I am sure it will be. We can get a bill through before Parliament rises. Ladies do not always know their own interests. Sometimes they do not know how to protect themselves, so the law must do it. Otherwise, any gallant can try to carry them off as a prize. Mr. Risley, would you take a note for me?
Call me Risley resumes his seat and dips a quill. He, Lord Cromwell, dictates.
An act against those who, without the king's permission, marry or attempt to marry the king's niece, sister, daughter.
Better throw in aunt, call me says.
He laughs. Throw in aunt, the offence will be treason. Tra-la! Cornby says, scribbling. Penalties, the usual. I get rich on the wording.
Meg is on her feet, bursting into tears again. Mr. Risley rises and takes charge.
Lady Margaret, you must go to the Tower. You will not be put in a dungeon. No doubt Lord Cromwell will arrange for you to have the late Queen's apartments.
He gathers his papers. He stands by the wall till the women are gone, sweeping by him without a word. But Cornby is restless, excited.
Who's going to break it to the king that Meg is married?
He sighs. I am.
I would not like to be in the Duke of Norfolk's shoes, Cormie says.
His niece disgraces him in spring and his half-brother in summer. You can easy pull him down now. Calmy flits a glance at him. If you want to. He thinks, I don't know that I do. I must consider the cost of more bloodshed. He says, I have aged into accommodation, Calmy. As you have noticed, this hour passed. It would be a meagre triumph to have saved the king's daughter if he now turns and executes his niece. When he goes to see Jane, the queen, he takes Mr. Risley with him. It is mid-morning, a broad summer light. The ladies have come from their devotions. Bess Uhtred, the queen's widowed sister, is at her side. On her other hand sits Edward Seymour's wife, Nan. The ladies are settling to the task which has absorbed them for weeks, erasing the initial A from satins and damasks and replacing it with Jane's initial so she can wear the clothes of the late queen. I remember sewing this one in. Bess's tone is low and absorbed. Seed pearls shower from her scissors. Jane is working on a private piece of sewing. Perhaps it is unbecoming in a queen to snip away her predecessor. Majesty, I have a request, and perhaps you will not like it. I must meet with those ladies who serve the late queen. We must invite them back to court. He feels suddenly very tired. I need to ask some questions. We must revisit certain matters that I wish were forgot. I pity Meg Douglas, Bess Uhtred says. The king should have found a husband for her long ago. Leave any sweet thing unattended and the Howards settle on it like flies. Who do you need? Nan asks him. Oh, who do you suggest? Mistress Mary Shelton. The queen smiles. She says, I don't mind if Mary Shelton comes back to court. She is not envious or mean. And, he thinks, the king's already had her. So that's one less thing for you to worry about. Jane says, if you are going to the king now, you will see he is wearing his Turkish costume. Try to be surprised. A crush of petitioners waiting outside the queen's room surges after him. He sees a man in young Richmond's livery and hails him. How is my lord today?
He is worse. The king should go, the man says. He should go and see his son.